So, well, certainly I'm wondering what you're waiting for. You're looking at me expectant. And what I thought of doing today is spending the day, spending the morning, our time together, doing just having some discussion. You can ask questions. We have questions and answers or some discussion about something that seems relevant. We don't do that often, and occasionally it's nice to do that. And so that's my proposal. We could do something else if someone else has another proposal. But if we do questions or discussion, and maybe perhaps some of you, it could be about anything. It could be about the practice, how to apply mindfulness practice in different parts of your life, or in your meditation, some difficulty you have, or questions about Buddhism, or anything that seems remotely relevant to our community. So, should we do that? Try to do that? And I can tell you that in Buddhism, it said you create very good karma for yourself by asking questions in the Dharma. Yes?
I like a little good karma. I have a question about the concept of evil in Buddhism as in Christianity or the religions and theology. There's sort of an entity, you know, a supernatural entity that provides the evil in the world. But in Buddhism, I don't think that's the case, but I'd like to hear your ideas, because on the September 11th events, we've heard a lot of words about
evil. So the topic of evil and what Buddhism has to say about evil, I don't feel like I know so well this topic, so I haven't studied it that carefully, and regret that. It won't help this discussion today, but I think it's in May, Stephen Batchelor is going to come to the Sati Center and do a day-long class on the topic of evil and Mara. And there are a couple of books on the topic. There's one book that compares the notion of Mara, or evil, in Buddhism and in Christianity. There is a satanic-like figure in Buddhist mythology or in Buddhist cosmology, and by the name of Mara. And Mara is the word Mara comes from the word for death, Marana in Pali, or it's actually closely connected to the word ambrosia in English, which is a Greek word. And you know, these wonderful ways in which Indo-European languages have common roots. And so the root for Mara and the word for ambrosia are the same. Ambrosia, the meaning of ambrosia is immortal, that which makes you immortal, the elixir of immortality. And amara, amrita in Sanskrit, is immortality, non-dying. And amrita became ambrosia. You can almost hear it, right? So Mara means comes from the word death, and sometimes Mara is described as the evil one in English translations, and the word that's being translated as evil is papa, and the opposite of papa is usually punya, and punya usually means merit, that which is meritorious, makes merit for you, is beneficial for your life, and papa is the extreme version of the opposite of that. And Mara is the evil one. And Mara is not responsible for all the evil in the world. However, Mara goes about doing evil deeds. And in particular, the job description of Mara is to avoid getting people enlightened. Kind of somehow stop people from getting enlightened. And so Mara then attacked the Buddha on the night of his enlightenment, trying to prevent it. People who commit a lot of papa, people who commit a lot of these evil deeds, will end up in Buddhist, traditional Buddhist cosmology or mythology, going to hell. It's quite serious business. The difference between Christian and Buddhist hell is that Buddhist hell is temporary. Though the span of time can be quite immense, it's still guaranteed to be temporary. Eventually you come out of it. Whereas in Christianity, I think it's eternity. And so there is this eternal external figure in Buddhism. However, the early Buddhist tradition in particular, the earlier you get, there's a strong tendency to see Mara not as an external figure, godlike figure, but rather see Mara as the personification of forces within the individual person. And so the daughters of Mara, the army of Mara, are things like greed and hate and conceit. And there's a list of 10 of them. I don't know them offhand. And so Mara is understood to be those forces inside of you which keep you in darkness, which keep you in not paying attention, not being really awake to what's going on in life right now, and keeps you from doing good in the world. And one of the principles in Buddhism is that if you liken awareness to light, the light of awareness, when it shines on something, when it shines on the wholesome qualities within us, tends to strengthen those. It's kind of like food for them. And when there's darkness, when there's no light, the darkness then will feed the unwholesome qualities within us. So things like greed and hate and conceit and jealousy and fear and many kind of the unwholesome or draining, unskillful qualities of mind will often get strengthened by being in the dark. If you don't pay attention to them, ignore them, they tend to to operate quite nicely and sometimes grow. It's kind of the analogy I like to use is that of a greenhouse. If you keep the greenhouse covered with curtains all the time, blacked in, then all that grows in the greenhouse is the mold. But if you pull the curtains apart and you let the sunshine in, then the plants in there can grow. So depending whether you have darkness or light, you have different things will grow. And so Mara thrives in the darkness. So the forces of Mara within us thrive in the darkness, and the forces of good or goodness thrive in the light. The forces. Buddhism tends not to use the word good and bad. It uses the word punya and papa. And again, punya is that which is meritorious, that which is beneficial, that which leads to beneficial results. Sometimes it's called skillful. It has skillful results. And papa is that which is unskillful results in the extreme. I think it's very instructive. It's very commonly told, this story, in our circles. But it's a very instructive story of when the Buddha had to contend with Mara in order to become enlightened. And the first story of that is that there's a lot of stories then in the Buddhist scriptures of Mara visiting someone. And in the story of a Buddha's enlightenment, one way of understanding it is that the Buddha was visited by doubt, self-doubt, about his right to become enlightened. And up until that point, he was able to rely on his own personal strength and his own personal discernment to kind of hold off the attack of Mara. But self-doubt was the strongest and was the one where he could no longer rely on himself. And then he said he touched his hand to the ground and called upon the Mother Earth, the Goddess Earth, to be his witness to his right to become enlightened. And sometimes there are times when we, you know, our connection to the nature, the earth, is that which reassures us for our, that we have the right to be complete or be relaxed or be whole or, many ways. It can be very helpful. So the Buddha did that in the light of his enlightenment. And that was what he needed to finally, the earth then shook. It was a massive earthquake and scared Mara away. But after his enlightenment, Mara continued to visit Buddha. And you might ask, you know, what is Mara still doing visiting the Buddha? If we understand Mara to be these internal psychic forces that we all have, isn't Buddhahood the complete elimination of all the unwholesome qualities within a person? And then what's Mara doing still visiting the Buddha? One interpretation of this is that a Buddha is actually not different than us. What's different is how the Buddha relates to these forces within us. And so it is not so much a matter of becoming pure of certain internal psychic forces as it is developing a new relationship to them. We don't have to stop having evil thoughts. We just stop having to be led around by them. And so what Mara does whenever, what Buddha does whenever Mara visits after his enlightenment, he simply says, "Mara, I see you." That's all. "Mara, I see you." He doesn't try to chase Mara away, and he doesn't invite Mara in for tea. He just clearly sees what's there. And every time Mara then runs away, just being, "I see you." There's a lot of stories in the early scriptures of Mara visiting a nun or a monk to try to convince the person to give up the monastic life, to give up the spiritual life. So he'll visit, you know, for example, some really beautiful young 20-year-old whatever nun, and will say, you know, "You're beautiful, and there's so much great pleasure in the world for you to have, and all you have to do is renounce your monastic vows, and I'll just offer you the most amazing sexual and sensual pleasure you can ever imagine. And you can always be a nun later in life, you know. Why don't you enjoy life now?" And you know, Samara uses whatever logic he can to try to get a person to stop following the path. And usually these stories have a good ending where the person says, "Mara, I see you." And Mara runs away. So there is such a figure in Buddhism. Yes? Can you speak a little bit louder, please? The notion of hell and heavens is part of traditional Indian cosmology. And traditional Indian cosmology also has this idea that there are different beings in different realms. There's the heavenly realms with the gods, many gods, and there's the animal realms, and there's the human realm, and there's the hungry ghost realm, which comes out very much on the 31st of October. And then there's the hell realms. And these different realms where beings can be reborn, because in the traditional Indian cosmology at the time of the Buddha, there was a notion of rebirth. And an individual keeps getting, gets reborn until they finally figure out a way to stop getting reborn. And it's kind of like Groundhog Day. So you keep coming back, you know, until you figure out lesson you need to learn to stop the reoccurrence. And so, depending on your actions, depending on what you do in your life, that affects how you get reborn. And it's a matter of how it perfumes or how it affects your consciousness. So if you spend a lot of time doing greedy things, then you have this like little greedy twist on your consciousness. And the moment you die, then there's a greedy spin on your consciousness. And that greedy spin somehow is a consciousness which conditions how you get reborn. So if there's this greedy spin on your consciousness, then you'll gravitate towards where there's, you know, some being where that's characterized by greed. If you have a lot of fear, for example, then you tend to gravitate to becoming an animal, they say, you know, if it's really, really... So if you spend a lot of time, for example, lying, then maybe they have all kinds of fanciful ideas about what the results of lying might be or anything. For example, if you spend a lot of time lying, maybe you get reborn mute. And so somehow that lying consciousness gravitates then towards someone who can't speak. Or maybe you gravitate towards being a wily fox, because foxes are kind of, you know, tricky animals maybe. Or if you do a lot of good things, then you gravitate to places where beings are really good. It's kind of, conscience has a spin on it. And we see that in daily life, in normal life, in us, you know, depending if you spend a lot of time developing a certain habit of mind, sometimes we tend to go in certain directions because that's the habit of mind we've created. And hell is one of the destinations in traditional mythology or Buddhist mythology or cosmology. But hell is temporary because nothing is permanent in Buddhism. There's no permanence anywhere to be found. And sooner or later, you'll die in hell realms, and then you get reborn someplace else. Or also in the heavenly realms, you eventually die. Being a god is really wonderful. There's a lot of beauty and pleasure in being a god. And the higher up you go, there's different realms, layers of heavens. And like 33, one category is a 33 heavens. And the higher you go up in these categories, the longer your lifespan will be. And you can have lifespan of, you know, hundreds of millions of years if you get up to the higher echelons. Because if your karma is just so amazingly good that you get reborn up there, you'll have 100 million years of this infinite divine celestial bliss and pleasure. It's really great. But sooner or later, you know, depending how high you go, might be later, you'll die. And then you'll. It's kind of like the human realm is in the middle. It's kind of like, imagine an hourglass, and this is how often the diagrams are. And the human realm is in the middle of that hourglass, and there's very, very few living beings which are humans compared to all living beings above it and all the living beings below it. And so there's a lot of gods, a lot more gods than there are humans, and a lot more, you know, things below than there are humans. And there's a kind of a gravitational pull towards the middle. So if you do a lot of good things, you'll get reborn higher up. But as you die, the gravitational pull is towards the middle again, unless you do more good things, more good karma. And if you get if you do really terrible things as a human being, you get reborn below that, you know, in the lower half of the hourglass. And the lower you go, in inverse proportion, kind of like inverse to kind of being heaven, the lower you go in the hell realms, there's all these different hell realms. I don't know how many there are in hell, but there's many. There's the ice hells and the fire hells. And, you know, ice hells are hells where there's all these icicles that kind of, you're kind of constantly stabbing you, and you're completely cold, and your teeth are just shattering to pieces. And, you know, there's these fire and brimstone kind of sermons that traditionally they give in Buddhism that, you know, describe these things to really frighten people into being good. And fire helms, you know, you can probably imagine, you know. And the further you down you go in hell, the longer you stay there. But sooner or later, you're going to die in hell also, because all beings die sooner or later. And then, because of this gravitational force thing, you tend to rise back towards the middle again and get another chance. Though sometimes your karma is so bad, you might actually get reborn again and again in hell until you kind of, you know, finished it. Does this help at all with your question? So please be careful with your karma. Some Buddhists will believe this very literally, and some Buddhists will take it to be a allegory or metaphor or something for what goes on in our own states of mind, moment by moment. In a given day, you can get your mind gets reborn in hell or heaven, depending on all kinds of conditions. So it's, you know, you can take it literally or figuratively. Yes. Oh. Conditioning. So the question of being conditioned. The teaching in Buddhism is that nothing whatsoever is self-existing. No thing in the world, nothing you can point to and talk about, is self-existing. It arises because of causes and conditions. So the analogy I used yesterday for this is that of a rainbow. We don't usually think of a rainbow as solidly existing out there. You know, it's not exactly a mirage, maybe, but it doesn't exactly exist either. But it's a coming together of different causes and conditions. Sunlight comes through. It has to be rain particles in the sky, and there has to be, you have to be situated in such a location that you can see how the light comes, and then you can see this rainbow. And so the rainbow existence is there because of certain conditions coming together. So in Buddhism, nothing self exists. Everything exists because of certain conditions coming together. And if certain conditions change, then things will change. So in terms of like rehabilitation of criminals, Buddhism will never say that a person is permanently sinful. This is their basic nature, inherent nature is to be evil. But the evil of individuals is there because of certain conditions. And if those conditions change, then the person can be changed, the person can be rehabilitated. And it's very humbling, these kind of teachings, because it means that you also would be very different if the conditions of your life were different. And, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh teaches it very beautifully, this. He says, you know, if I had grown up, he probably would have said, if I had grown up in a refugee camp, you know, I might have ended up being a terrorist. If the conditions of being such tremendous suffering and neglect, I wouldn't have had the inner resources to have avoided being angry and afraid and acted out in certain ways. And I might have been a killer. Human beings are tremendously malleable. And a lot of different things will influence who we are and what we are. And many of us would like to have the idea that we are kind of solid and secure and we know who we are and we're not going to change in any way. But in fact, if you look at ourselves over 10, 20, 30 years, we often change quite a bit. There might be certain things we recognize as being somewhat core to who you are, but even some of the core things can change sometimes. It was very interesting for me to grow up in different cultures. I grew up quite a bit in Italy and Switzerland and America and in Norway and speak a number of different languages. And I reckon that when I was 18, I noticed that how different I was in different languages. It was like I had learned different way of being in the world, different kind of rules, of how, different ways of relating to people, different ways of expressing myself in different languages, so that if I wanted to express certain things I can only express in Italian. You know, just I didn't know how to do it in English. You know, this was part of it. And I had a friend. I mean, I noticed in other people too. One person who I really liked a lot, as long as he spoke English. But when he spoke Norwegian, I didn't care for him because it was like a different personality that came through. He grown up in an aristocratic, kind of conservative business world of Oslo, and he had this kind of whole. It wasn't just simply the way he spoke. He had almost like, with the language came a certain worldview almost. And his English he'd learned in hippie communes in the 60s in America. And so it wasn't just simply, you know, he had this laid-back way of talking, but he had a certain view of, you know, that came through a little bit, was perfumed by the language he spoke. So human beings are somewhat conditioned. We're conditionable. I mean, I feel it right now that there's a tremendous amount of patriotism in our country. There's a lot of pressure to be patriotic without a lot of analysis of what it means to be patriotic and what are all the varieties of ways that you're allowed to be patriotic. I mean, someone can be phenomenally patriotic and be against the war in Afghanistan, but you're not allowed that. There's not a lot of permission for that, and so there's certain pressure to conform in a certain way, So nothing is self-existing. Things arise in dependence or based on conditions. But we can affect those conditions. And so part of what Buddhist practice traditionally involves is adjusting or changing those conditions to make them more beneficial, more helpful and useful for you and the world around you. And so it's considered very hard to engage in the goal of Buddhist practice is to become awakened and free, liberated. But it's not, and liberation has nothing to do with the world of conditions. So there's a word, the word condition in English, in Buddhist circles, also has this meaning I'm talking about now, that things are conditioned. Nothing's independent, things are conditioned by everything else. Cause and effects come together. So they say in Buddhism that everything is has a conditioned existence, or sometimes translated into English as everything is constructed or fabricated. No thing is self-existing, spontaneously born. Everything is fabricated by causes and conditions. Except the one so-called thing which is not fabricated. Actually, depending on the school of Buddhism, there's a number of things which are called not conditioned. They're usually translated into English as the unconditioned. And one of those sometimes is space. Some Buddhists will argue that space is unconditioned. You can't fabricate space. It's always there in a sense. And it's unborn. It doesn't suddenly appear out of nowhere. And it doesn't disappear ever. Space is always there, they say. So it's an unconditioned kind of thing, a reality. It's not exactly a thing, I suppose. And the other thing which is unconditioned is nirvana. And nirvana, nibbana, is understood different way by different Buddhists. But for our purposes, we can understand it to be the nature of a liberated awareness, liberated consciousness. If you step into, if you're very still and very peaceful and very quiet, you might have a sense of being in a timeless present. There are moments where we kind of find ourselves, it feels timeless now. And that sense of timeless present often comes with a lot of other qualities. Sometimes it comes with a feeling of well-being, of feeling very kind of holistic feeling. Sometimes it comes with a feeling being connected to things around you and everything. It can come with different things, but the kind of feeling of timeless, this moment is timeless. It's never been born, it never dies, it always is. But you don't want to talk to a physicist about, what timeless moment is. It's kind of like, it's a psychological state of, you can attribute timelessness then to something external, but it's really a function of consciousness, of awareness, that it perceives and holds everything in a way that it feels timeless. So in the same way, nirvana is kind of like, it's called a deathless awareness. It's also a kind of awareness which is not related to anything. It's not conditioned by anything. It's not affected by anything. So, it's very hard to talk about this because as soon as I don't want to be pinpointed for what I'm saying or held to what I'm saying, but nirvana is one of the most difficult things to talk about. Because mostly in language, we use our language, we understand things by what things refer to. So space, for example, it's hard to point to space unless we refer to the space that's bounded by this room. So we can describe the space in this room because it has a reference point. But the unconditioned consciousness doesn't have any reference point for understanding it. So it's very hard to talk about it that way. So there is something which is unconditioned. And the conditioned world can't create the unconditioned. You can't create space. You can kind of make a room and then say there's space inside of it. But this, when this was all open fields before they built this auditorium, there was, all this space, all this sky, all this space all around, right? And the fact that you built these walls around, this didn't make space. If you make your two hands closely together, and there's no space between my hands now, and am I making space when I open them up like this? So the theory in Buddhism or the teaching is that the conditioned world can't create the unconditioned. So then becomes there's this kind of very strange disconnect between the ultimate goal of spirituality and the world we usually negotiate, where we're trying to manipulate things and change things and condition things in some way. However, the traditional teaching is that you cannot create and make the unconditioned. You can't make it happen. You can't will it. However, you can create the conditions that support its arising. And so, traditionally in Buddhism, you want to spend part of Buddhist practice then is helping you make the right conditions so that awakening can occur. One cliche is that, as people say, is that enlightenment is an accident, but you can make yourself accident prone. And so, for example, if you spend your whole time preoccupied by something, that preoccupied state and the habit to keep being preoccupied, your consciousness is always focused on something then. And if you're always preoccupied, you're not allowing for the conditions for some unconditioned thing to arise in. It's like if you're always talking in a conversation, if you're always butting in and talking and talking, you're not allowing for the possibility for someone else to speak and to hear something new from the other person. So if the mind is always preoccupied, you don't create the possibility of something new occurring, which is the unconditioned. And so part of what meditation is about is learning slowly to free yourself from all the ways in which the mind gets preoccupied, latches on, holds on, obsesses about things. Certain things condition the mind to do that more than others. So if you do a lot of evil acts, if you do a lot of unskillful things, that makes it increasingly hard to have the sensitivity to do that inner work of becoming freer from the obsessions. It's kind of like if you do unskillful things, you can only do unskillful things, evil things, unskillful things, unwholesome things, if to some degree you're in the dark. That's what I talked about earlier. And so the more unskillful things you do, the more forces of darkness you create. But in order to be free, you have to create more light. And so in order to create more light, you have to do wholesome things, things that support your compassion, your love, your discernment, your feeling of responsibility, your loving kindness, your generosity. There's many things, inner qualities that you want to develop. So part of Buddhist practice traditionally is to not just simply develop mindfulness, but to create conditions, to condition yourself through your actions of body, speech, and mind. So to perform bodily, mental, and verbal acts of generosity, of loving kindness, of compassion, of patience. To do these kinds of things in order to condition certain habit formation, certain kind of mind that is more sensitive to forces of goodness. And if you do that, it becomes a lot easier for the accident of awakening to occur. It's kind of like, however, the caveat for this is that the goodness that you do is not going to cause you to be awakened. So you don't want to get attached to the goodness, which some people do. You know, this goodness means I'm really pure, or whatever. Goodness is, it can be a trap also. So Buddhism warns against, doesn't warn against doing good deeds and good acts and good states of mind. It warns very much against being attached to it, or having too high of expectation that it's the goodness that you're doing that's going to cause you to be free. It's not going to cause you to be free. You might actually continue to stay stuck, even if you're very good. And if you're really, really good, the way you get stuck is you get stuck by getting reborn in the heavenly realms. Now, that's not a bad deal, but it's not a bad deal, but it's not ideal, because you're still stuck in the cycles of rebirth. And the traditional goal of Buddhism is to somehow step off the cycles of rebirth. Whether you, for traditional Buddhists, that means really stop being reborn entirely. For a lot of more modern Buddhists who kind of demythologize the tradition, it means somehow learning to step off the endless treadmills and cycles in which the mind is on moment by moment, and to have some experience of the unconditioned, the timeless, kind of step off. Was that too long of an answer? Yes. Oh, there's nothing. It's not meritorious at all. There's no merit to being enlightened. Because you step outside of this. You step outside of the whole cycle of merit and demerit. You're no longer playing the game.
Why
is that cool? Because the cycles of merit and demerit are cycles of suffering. And so if you want to really be free of suffering, you want to step outside of the cycles that have suffering as inherent part of it. Because people want to be happy. People don't want to suffer. People want to have, there's a motivation to be liberated from suffering.
Without existence, how can there be either happiness or suffering? That there's happiness in some plane where there's no suffering?
It's a completely logical and reasonable question you're asking. Buddhism doesn't want to answer those questions. What happens to a person what happens to an enlightened person when that person dies is not a question to be asked. It's not a useful question. It can't be answered. It's not the case that the person doesn't exist anymore. It's not the case that the person does exist anymore. It's not the case that the person both exists and doesn't exist. And it's not the case that the person neither exists nor not exists. It's someone that doesn't want to relate. It's like the question doesn't pertain. So I don't know what kind of analogy would point to this best, but the classic Buddhist analogy is that of a candle flame, and for ancient Indians, when the candle flame is extinguished, which nirvana sometimes understood to be a description of the extinguishing of the candle, for us it's kind of a nihilistic message. The flame is not there, it's not there, it's gone, But for ancient Buddhists, fire, the candle fire, the flame, represents heat, a certain kind of condensed form of heat. And when you extinguish the flame, heat doesn't disappear. Heat is still there in some way. And what the ancient Buddhist said, heat then is liberated from the candle. The heat is liberated and goes out freely throughout the cosmos. So the flame is making this heat, and that heat doesn't just disappear. It gets thinned out and diluted, and pretty soon you go far enough away from the candle, you don't feel the heat. But the heat gets liberated. So when you snuff out a candle, you've liberated, consciousness gets liberated. So consciousness normally is always bound to what it knows. And so you can define it by what it knows. But when consciousness is no longer bound to what's knowable, then it can't be defined. Another example sometimes used is that of sunlight. I'm not a physicist, so I don't know if this is really the case, but it seems to be that you don't see sunlight unless it strikes something. But you don't say that sunlight doesn't exist. But you don't really know it until it strikes something. It strikes the ground or strikes the atmosphere or something. And so consciousness, when you set free, can't be seen exactly. But you won't know it because there's nothing for it to strike anymore. So the normal categories of how we understand existence and human being some don't apply in this kind of state. So traditional Buddhists who believe in rebirth don't seem to have any trouble with the idea that it's desirable to attain nirvana. They don't believe it's non-existence. It's very clear. It's one of the basic dogmas of Buddhism that an enlightened person isn't simply extinguished upon death. But you also don't want to say that that person exists after death. So, you're kind of left frustrated. And traditional Buddhists are very motivated, much more than people often in the West are, especially people who live fairly comfortable lives, to want to get off the wheel. Many of us don't believe in rebirth to begin with, so it's not like an interesting question. But even some people who believe in some kind of rebirth, Christians believe that you have one rebirth in a sense. You die and then you have one chance. You either go to hell or heaven or purgatory. And then it's there you are. But traditionally Buddhists, the idea of being reborn is really oppressive because they're not born on the peninsula in relatively comfortable circumstances. most traditional Indians looked around them. It was like being born in Afghanistan. I mean, imagine being reborn in Afghanistan every time. I mean, you know, every birth you're going to be born in Afghanistan, and they're always fighting there. And there's, you know, I mean, they've been fighting Afghanistan for millennia, each other, and the survival of a woman giving birth in Afghanistan probably today is probably very low. I think most women died in childbirth until recent years. I mean, it was a painful thing to give birth. It was deadly. It was lethal for a lot of people. A lot of children were stillborn. A lot of children died. And a lot of people, the life expectancy was pretty low, and people died in childhood. They died. You know, life was really rough and difficult. And there was traditionally, people looked around and saw a lot of suffering. And they just simply didn't want to get reborn in this realm where there's so much suffering. Chances were, if they got reborn, they weren't going to be reborn in states of privilege. So they wanted to, and the idea of kind of doing this again, it's so exhausting. I mean, it's like being a teenager again. I mean, how many of you would like to be a teenager, you know, another 12 times? Without the wisdom that you've gathered from the first time, right? I mean, give me a break, you know. So traditional Buddhists have a strong notion they want to finish. For people who don't, Buddhists who don't, you don't have to believe in rebirth and that cosmology, mythology of rebirth in order to do Buddhist practice. For people who don't believe in it, then it's really this notion that you get reborn moment by moment. And when the liberation is when you step outside of cycles of the mind being reactive. And if the mind is always being reactive to something, the mind is not free. A non-reactive mind, what is it? If you really have experienced the depth of what a non-reactive mind is, you can't exactly say that it exists or doesn't exist, because it doesn't have any reference point to it. And if you've attained some very deep peace that appears to you to be non-reactive, it probably isn't the same thing that Buddhists are pointing to, because they're pointing to something much more profound and deeper. So if you hang out, if you experience very deep peace in meditation, then a meditation teacher will tell you, look more carefully. And you'll find, oh, actually, there's still some stress there. There's still a little bit of clinging there. Okay, what happens if I let go of that too? And so, you know, when the Buddhists point to a non-reactive mind or awareness of Nibbana, you've had that taste. You can't really say it exists or doesn't exist. You can't say that it was born, that it dies. It doesn't compute. The timeless present, does it die? Does it disappear? The timeless present, does it exist? Does it not exist? It doesn't really exist like you and I exist. But we're not going to say it doesn't exist, because the timeless present, that was the most, you know, one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had. You know, it had a big influence on the rest of my life, this timeless moment that I experienced. So I'm not going to say it doesn't exist. But I can't say it does exist, can you? I'm trying. Last one, and then we'll stop.
How do Buddhist families teach their children Buddhism?
Probably every way that Christians and Jews teach their families the same thing. I mean, there's, you know, Buddhists do a lot of, there's a lot of, you know, different, you know, there are. If you go, probably go to the Japanese Pure Land Temple on Lewis in Palo Alto, they probably have Sunday school. I mean, they adopted a lot of Western. They came to America and they tried to fit in and not be discriminated against, and so they kind of adopted a lot of Western church ideas. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, Sunday was a day off, so let's, you know, we're working other days, so let's do our thing on Sunday too, and then, because when we're coming to the temple anyway, then let's, you know, that's when we can teach our children. So in Thailand and Burma especially, it was really beautiful to see. They would ordain young children as novice monks and nuns. And when I was in the monastery, there was a kind of around Easter time, there was a school holiday of 1 or 2 weeks, and suddenly there appeared hundreds of these little monks and nuns, you know, they had heads shaved and they wore these, you know, the Buddhist robes, And they went there and they were taught meditation and taught different Buddhist principles and ideas. So it's kind of like Sunday school, like Easter school, I guess, camp. And what impressed me the most was that the Burmese family structure is very patriarchal, very hierarchical. It's a very hierarchical kind of culture in some ways. And the children are not so very, in the family, are not very high up in the hierarchy. And however, when the child is ordained as a novice, it's a temporary ordination, just, you know, for the holiday, they now have a higher status than their parents. And so they would have the experience, they would get to sit in the chair, and their parents would be on the floor below them, bowing to them. And so they're kind of treated like royalty. So growing up, they have this experience of feeling, you know, that there's this tremendous self-worth or dignity or that they're capable of having, that even their parents will bow to them. So that's a kind of Buddhist education. There are various kinds of Jataka tales and some various kinds of Buddhist-like stories. I have this 3-year-old and he likes to be read to a lot, but I actually haven't found myself any of these stories that work for me so well to read to him. Some of the messages I don't care for, and somehow they don't work. So I don't really have anything, you know, in terms of. If a kid is, you know, getting to be about 12 or 13, 14 years old, some kid, depending on their maturity and interest, the book Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse can be a big influence. Siddhartha. And at that age, some kids will start reading books like that. And it's a very idealized, almost romanticized view. But it's, you know, for that age, it kind of works and inspires a lot of kids and speaks to them. So I don't know. I mean, different Buddhists will decide different things.
Do the children start sitting at an early age?
In Burma, for example, they did. They had little meditation sessions for these kids, and I don't know how young is the youngest. There's some notion in Buddhism that I don't know where this comes from exactly, but that the youngest age a person can get enlightened is at 7.
7.
Yeah. And before that, they don't have enough development to do what it takes. But for me, I'm a kind of a Buddhist teacher in a community, and I've run, you know, for about 4 years, I had this children's program. Now it's turned it over to Jim and Cheryl, who are doing it. But in my own family and also in running that children's program, I wasn't trying to make kids Buddhists. Mostly what I was trying to do was to teach them good skills and good kind of values that would help them in their life, and to have some relationship, and to have some relationship to Buddhism, like the Buddha and Buddha statue, that would give them a positive regard, kind of a warmth or kind of a for those images, so they can speak somehow deeper in their psyche, maybe as they grow up in a way that's useful. So, for example, there were a lot of girls who came to the children's program when I did it. There were boys too, but a lot of girls. And so, partly because of that, but partly because it's what I had, the Buddha figure I had was Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, was a bodhisattva of compassion. But I always called it for them, this is a Buddha, a female Buddha. Because I wanted them to be clear that a Buddha could be a woman also, even though in traditional Buddhist, let's call it mythology, women cannot become Buddhas. Not possible. It's impossible. So you have to be reborn as a man in order to become a Buddha. So I had this woman, and then sometimes I tell little stories, Jataka tales that I kind of adopted. And I would sometimes talk about that Buddha image, and I'd say, well, I'd talk, where is the Buddha? What's the Buddha? And they would say, they'd learn after a while, the Buddha is these good qualities inside of you, like love and compassion and generosity. That's where the Buddha is. And the statue was just kind of a reflection of these qualities inside of you. And once I did, once I had them all write on a piece of paper, their individual good qualities that they had. And then we took and we taped those good qualities on the inside of the Buddha. They're still there, you know. And once I had I took a little round mirror and I put it, Buddha sits there like this, right? And I put the mirror on their hand, I put the mirror in the hand of the Buddha, and I said, this is a really special mirror, because whoever looks in this mirror will see the Buddha in themselves. Or we'll see a really special Buddha, I think I said. So he wants to go look first, and they go look in the mirror, and you know, they see themselves. And so, I mean, it's a little bit, you know, I have some idea that maybe it's a wholesome thing to have people having good, you know, good connection to the mythology, the imagery and the symbolism of Buddhism and the values there. But I myself don't have any notion that I'm trying to make kids Buddhist children or grow up to be Buddhists. And I have no notion of my son that I'm trying to make him a Buddhist. It's important for me. It'd be nice that he shares my positive regard for Buddhism and has appreciation for its value. And you know, he's going to grow up with a lot of it around him and with me talking about it and stuff. But I'm not going to any kind of way, you know, I don't think I'm going to be trying to make him into a Buddhist. Right.
You need to give them, I think there are times when it would be good to give a child something.
It's possible. It's in a culture where a lot of people around you have that, it can be helpful to have that, some strength and some stability and so yeah, it could be useful in certain cultures situation to have that. And you know, So, I mean, certainly there are other Buddhist teachers who would be much more gung-ho and you know, in raising children as Buddhist. And I have a lot of respect for that. I don't have a problem with that, per se. It's just my own way of, you know, my own way. And it's a characteristic of a lot of the European-American, not some of the European-American Buddhists in America, kind of convert Buddhists, is that many of them are not that interested in raising their children as Buddhists. So it's kind of like, it's going to die with them, you know, because if you don't, you know, have the next generation, where it's going to go. But we'll see, you know, so there's some of these children that I did a children program for, they became teenagers and left the program, and their parents tell me they have very little interest in meditation now, although occasionally they'll tell their mother, you know, you need to go meditate now. And my hope is that the parents' example is really important. So rather than teaching them something, you teach them by how we live. And if they see that this is valuable for us, or see skills that we're learning and values we're learning, that they pick them up from us. And I hope that for some of these children, as they grow up into adulthood, at some point, if they suffer enough in their life, have enough difficulty, that they'll remember in a very positive way the resources that were helpful for their parents, and they might go try it out for themselves. And so it's really, you're waiting for them to get turned 30. And that's my point of view. Other people have different points of view on this. So, thank you for your questions, and I'm sorry that I talked so long so there weren't more questions. And I appreciate them all, and now we'll have our potluck. You're all welcome to stay. And the last thing I'll say is that one of the possible things I thought might happen today in doing questions and open for discussion is there might have also been some more discussion about how to relate to war and terrorism and September 11th. And we've had a lot of it already, but there's so much anxiety going on in our society right now. I've never experienced so much anxiety in American culture as I'm experiencing now in my lifetime. And a lot of it is shared in our community. And we should all be very sensitive to the fact that a lot of people find it very trying and very difficult and very exhausting, and to be really careful with yourself and with your neighbors and people, and to realize, don't take it so personally that maybe that some of you feel very anxious it's kind of in the society around us. And that if some of you feel that our meditation community should be addressing these things and you want to talk and discuss these things as a community more, let me know what your feelings are about it. Because without, you know, otherwise I'm just guessing or kind of sensing. And so if there's a strong need, we'll try to, you know, try to meet it if we can. So thank you all, and I wish you a happy week, and I hope that this week allows you to create the conditions for more happiness, and that some of your week can be heavenly.